Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's episode of New Books Network. I'm Origno Gupto, your host, and I have Anindita as my co-host today. And we will be interviewing Dr. Razak Khan on his book, Minority Pasts. Anindita, welcome. Razak, welcome.
Hi, thanks. Thanks, Origno, for agreeing to co-host this episode with me. NBN has been a space, which allows us to not just, meet scholars who work on, areas that interest us, but also, other graduate students like you, who are working on similar areas. So I'm really fascinated by the prospect that NBN has for us. So I do invite Dr. Razak Khan to the New Book Network for doing this podcast with us and for talking about his book, The Minority Past, with us.
Hi. I am a doctoral candidate in history, just to introduce myself, and I'm dissertating, and I work on early colonial vocabularies of sovereignty and the people in Eastern India. So as a result, I found the analysis of a princely state over almost a century really fascinating to think through different ideas of sovereignty. And that's one of the reasons I was led to this book. Anindita, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi. Yeah. I'm Anindita. I am a doctoral scholar at the Department of History, University of Illinois, Chicago. And the book grabbed my interest for similar reasons, because my dissertation and archival work focuses on the princely states of South Asia, and I'm interested in looking at the afterlives of the princely states as they become a part of the two, three nations that we have. In the region, though I precisely look at India and Bangladesh and how the Eastern princely states become a part of these two nations, and what are their afterlives and what has that done to the region. And and Dr. Razak's book has, his research work and his book has always been a part of my bibliography from the day I began working on this. So I'm glad that this is, that we are able to do this. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Yes. So Dr. Khan is a research fellow in the History Research Group at the Center for Modern Indian Studies at the University of Göttingen. He studied modern Indian history at the University of Delhi and was awarded a DPhil from the Berlin Graduate School in 2014. Subsequently, he was a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for the History of Emotions at the Max Planck Institute for Human Development in Berlin and at the Erlangen Center for Islam and Law in Europe. His research interests include early modern and modern Indian history, South Asian Islam and Muslim cultures, Urdu public cultures and archives, history of emotions, comparative Indo-German histories, and global intellectual history. So on that note, welcome Dr. Khan.
Thank you, Arigno and Anandita. It's great pleasure to be in conversation with new scholars working in the similar field. I look forward to our conversation.
A little bit about the book, Minority Pasts, Locality, Emotions, and Belonging in Rampur explores the diversity of the histories and identities of Muslims in Rampur, the last Muslim-ruled princely state in colonial United Provinces, and a city that is pejoratively labeled as the center of Muslim vote bank politics in contemporary Uttar Pradesh. The book highlights the importance of locality and emotions in shaping Muslim identities, politics, and belonging in Rampur. It appeals to us to move beyond such homogenous categories of nation and region in order to comprehend local dynamics that allows a better and closer understanding of historical renegotiation of politics and identities by Muslims in South Asia. Interestingly, this is the first comprehensive English language monograph on the local history of politics of Rampur princely state, based on Persian, Pashto, Urdu, Hindi, and English archives and oral histories of Rampuris. The book provides insights into the various facets of the political, economic, religious, literary, sociocultural, and affective history of Rampur and Rampuris in India and Pakistan. Broadly, the book will allow the readers to explore the historiography of Muslim identity and princely state politics in colonial South Asia. I will open up the forum for Razak to talk more about it, but I think Arigno will start with the questions first.
Yeah, thanks, Anindita. So I think we could start by a general overview about about Razak's career trajectory and ask him as to like how the journey from Delhi University classrooms to the completion of this book. You know, what? How did you how would you characterize your journey in conceptualizing this really fascinating book?
Yeah, thank you. I imagine we all shared those classrooms at some point or the other. So as you would know, Delhi University is not only a premier center, it's also a center with diverse set of teaching options, and you benefit from teachers not just at the university level, but also from undergraduate teachers who often, if you're lucky, also teaching at the master's level. So my year at Delhi University was enriched both by the department teachers, and I want to acknowledge particularly the wonderful classes on social history of modern India by Professor Dilip Menon, who ensured that we read widely and not just on the themes that were relevant only for the syllabus. That allowed one to sort of read around topics that were diverse, but in some way also learn to connect things. Prosama Faruqi gave some wonderful lectures that, made political and administrative history, which is no longer that much considered fashionable, but is of course very important. So his lectures on the administrative apparatus of the Raj were very important influence to me. I was also lucky because, Professor Gyan Pandey used to famously teach a course on communalism in modern India, which had sort of stopped once he left. But it was during my time that Professor Anshu Malhotra revived that course. And that was a very formative course for me because it was one of the courses that sort of did fully address the question of Muslim politics. So I would say these courses, and I think that's important, teaching methods and course syllabus can really shape your trajectory of research. And of course, once teachers are not just in the classroom, they're also books and people you re-meet through their work. So I would say that the work of Gyan Pandey was quite influential for me with his attention to archive and historiography. And of course, in my field on Muslim politics, I've been a committed reader of Barbara Metcalfe and Professor David Lelyweld, who really shaped my choice for a local study.
That's fascinating. Yeah, there are so many overlapping interests and paths that that we are also taking as we go through this process. But yeah, that's great. That's great.
Also all familiar names, so one feels very comfortable. No wonder reading Minority Past was such a comfortable experience for us, because one knows that one was falling back on similar bibliographic histories. Razak, I was I'm keen to know more about your your journey towards towards finalizing or, or settling on working on the princely state of Rampur or, or Rampur, or Rampuris. And what made you decide that this is, this is what you want to, work on, or this is something that needs, an elaborate, elaborate historical journey, an archival journey, journey on your part. So yeah, we would be interested in knowing what were, what led you to working on this.
Yeah, so again, that choice happened partly out of a classroom task that we were doing, which was to read colonial document. In this case, of course, it was the Champaran document of Prosesh, the means class, but that foray into the National Archive and looking to documents and sources of vernacular newspaper report. That was my way of going about choosing a case study. I knew that I didn't want to work on Delhi and Lucknow. I wanted to work basically on a Muslim urban history. And that choice was governed by the logic that I wanted to write not a larger historiography on Muslim or British India, but I wanted to think through that question from a location that is not considered central to that problematic, which is why I also not didn't choose Hyderabad or Bhopal, who were sort of still sort of written about. Rampur happened to be come to my plate in this way, or it found me through itself, because I'm not from Rampur. I had no connection with Rampur. It kept emerging into the vernacular newspaper report of United Provinces as in the realm of scandal news reporting and communal questions around Muslim politics of that time. And a visit to Rampur, because they have a wonderful library, then made that choice easy for me. But I was initially going to look at a place like Moradabad, which was also fascinating to think about question of caste and labor for Muslim politics. So it was among a range of other choices, but eventually I chose it because of also a diverse range of sources available around it. Yeah.
Certainly. So when you, as you mentioned, that there's the diversity of sources that kind of opens up to the archives and as students of history, and I know we both come from slightly different ways of approaching history, but the use of archives and the depth of it was quite intriguing and it's a learning experience. Could you tell us how the research sort of operated or emerged out of the different archives? And at least there are like more than five that I could locate, and there are several different genres of sources, and they're also multilingual. So how did, and with, I kind of also felt that the different language, the registers of language, was used as a way to come up with a unique argument that is specific to that kind of the register of the archives. So could you tell us a little bit about the way this is also a critical reflection of colonial production of space through your archival, journey?
Yeah, I'm a believer of the old style archivally situated history writing, which is why I found Gyan Pandey's model of writing particularly appealing, because he has a way of making an extremely theoretical argument through what I call staging an archival scene. So he was a huge influence for me to pay particular attention to a variety of archive while making an argument. Although Rampur has a famous Rampur as a library, indeed the archival journey was quite difficult, because the archival document of the Rampur state are not in Rampur. So that sort of complicated and made the journey, made me actually react and adapt to the situation. So of course the National Archives in Delhi were an initial source, but they were largely British sources, and I didn't want to write that kind of history. So I ended up spending some time in Rampur. Rampur as a library has diverse sources, mostly in Persian, Urdu, and some Pashto sources. It also has two other smaller libraries that I consulted, the Solat Public Library and a private madrasa library, Madrasa Furqaniya. And I talk in the different chapter how I reach those archives and what they how they influence not just as a source of document, but how they also made me look at different aspect of Rampur's history. And perhaps I will can speak about that as we discuss different chapters. Just very briefly, I think the point is right, and I'm glad you noticed it. So the question of archival is not about information. It's also about staging a historical argument according to the genre of archive, which is why I chose a range of sources. So there's poetry, there are there are a variety of Urdu genres, we can speak specifically about them, tarikh, tazkiras, and all. But I was also interested in thinking about sound archive, visual archives of music, of I was particularly intrigued by a small collection of public poster ishtihar that I thought were very fascinating. We have think about publicness. So yes, I and multilingualism is of course important for a diversity of archive. And my journey on that has been slow, but I've been always interested in sort of expanding my own range of sources. So I, of course, in the Delhi University, I was trained in Urdu by the, in the Urdu Studies Department. In Berlin, I was lucky because here you can actually learn Pashto. It's one of the strange or interesting legacies of GDR that you can learn Afghan languages in Berlin. So I learned Pashto and Farsi here. And that sort of over years allowed me to expand my archival base. So you see that in the dissertation growth into a postdoctoral project. Yeah. So this is how the both the archival range shifts as I made advances in my language requirement. Yeah.
Given, I mean, you are definitely accessing a huge range of archive and, in different languages, and through different approaches, and I think that all of that is evident, evident in the way your project is shaped. However, what I find very interesting is your introduction where you have solidly, located your work by drawing on all the historiography, that you can, and I think that makes it a really sound introduction, a sound introduction. So, but for the purposes of the podcast, would you help us understand, would you help us understand how you situate yourself within the, larger, larger historiography, in your field, and or what all, subfields that you refer to or think you would want the readers to, think of as they read the book?
Yeah, sure. Although this book is now being read, and of course, rightfully so, as part of princely state historiography, my initial foray was actually around the question of languages of politics. And that interest had come from, of course, Muzaffar Alam's book on language of politics and critique in Mughal India, but also works of Douglas Haynes, Ravindra Kumar, Gyan Pandya, among others. So I was interested in thinking about how do people think and talk about politics. But I was not interested in the grander scale of politics. There I was more interested in the debate. It's no longer discussed, but I was fascinated by the debate around locality and nationalism debate, the Cambridge School argument. So part of that was an engagement with Chris Bailey's work in particular, both in Rural Establishments and Bazaar and his first work on Allahabad. But I wanted to sort of look at that Cambridge argument from a different lens, not in its utilitarian argument, but to think what might a local study allows us to think and re-ask new question about what is Muslim politics. So that was another set of broad historiographical question. And in that, I of course, was guided by the exemplary work of David Lelieveld and Barbara Metcalf on two smaller locations and how they sort of emerge as an important center for Muslim politics beyond Delhi and Lucknow. So as I start in the book, I begin with Barbara Metcalf's formulation about too much and yet too little about this field. So it is, of course, located, and I'm interested in making intervention in that field about what constitutes Muslim politics, how do we think and write about it, particularly under colonialism. But I didn't want to write on that in British India. I wanted to make an argument through a space where Muslims were technically not disempowered, but I wanted to sort of then explore different hierarchies of Muslim politics within the Muslim community. So of course I'm interested, and whenever possible I bring Hindus of Rampur into the history, but I consciously wanted to focus on the different levels within Muslim politics and identity. That was a one broad field. I'm also interested in questions around Urdu public cultures and archive. And I thought this case study allowed me to ask some of those questions beyond just a literary reading. So I wanted to bring Urdu literary studies, which are prolific, into conversation on Muslim identity politics. So you would see that the book sort of weaves both a literary and a historical argument together. And lastly, I would say, of course, princely states matter. And I think I started taking that question much more seriously and in an interesting way, because I myself was surprised with what I found in the case study. There was a variety of things happening in princely India. And during my research work, of course, new work came that was not in the traditional mold. And I here want to mention Siobhan Lambert Hurley's work on Bhopal and Kavita Datla's work on Hyderabad. So they asked different kind of question on Muslim princely state. And that is another realm in which I want to intervene by saying, what can princely state historiography tell us, not just about princely state, but about the larger historiography on colonial India? So I would say the intersection of these three fields, I sort of try to place my work.
That is really fascinating. It's also reflective of you know, writing the national and through the local and the local international. So there's a move that you mentioned.
Yeah.
But before we go further, you know, get into further exploration, I just realized that a lot of our audience would not grasp the context of Rampur, and I feel that, you know, in the context of the fragment and the nation, do you mind just painting a rough sketch from Mughal Rampur to the post-colonial Rampur, a little bit in terms of where does this princely state stand in terms of histories of South Asia or histories of, you know, global histories that we kind of come across?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the more interesting thing about Rampur case study was also it allowed me to sort of map that arc of pre-colonial, in fact, post-Mughalai. And in a very interesting way, I start in the 18th century, and it allowed me to make a sort of argument also in 18th century historiography, because Rampur emerged from the Rohilla chieftaincy's politics of 18th century. So looking at from that perspective, so Rampur is part of what is now known as the Rohilkhand region, bordering closer part of British India, closer to Bareilly, Muradabad, and Nainital. But it encompasses and has a history in the 17th and 18th century of Rohilla horse traders who then made their little, you know, vatans or riyasat in different parts. These include not just Rampur, but places in Bareilly, Badayun, Shahjanpur, among others. All fascinating case studies in their own right. Rampur just happened to become the center of it in wake of the Anglo-Rohilla War. And in 1774, the state is literally created out of different, it is in fact constructed as a way of controlling these diverse Rohilla leaders and sort of localizing them. So locality itself is, as I insist, is a sort of historical production to sort of build a more unified Rohilla polity here. So it does start in the post-Mughal, declining Mughal, rising Awadh state, rising company state here. But it has its own dynamic that people like Jos Commons and hopefully very soon Naveen Naqvi's book will also reveal. These are histories of their own right. They deserve much more interesting research. But I didn't go too much into that. I start with 1774, but broadly I was interested in post-1857 reconfiguration of this polity. So it's in that sense centrally placed in post-1857 context. Rampur's not only survived, it was an ally, so it benefited from the post-mutiny dislocation. And so it is a very tiny state, tiny locality with some additional kasbas that are in the book, but the book is pretty much about the city of Rampur, which was also the state name. It, of course, was called Mustafabad in 1774, but the name just didn't circulate beyond the state archive. And I sort of look at why Rampur remains the name. There's something to be said about what circulates. And subsequently, through the arc from 1857 to 1949, by which the state is integrated, I look at three different Nawabs to map three different moments of staging and critiquing sovereignty and polity. But I was not happy on ending this arc on a princely state narrative of 1857 and 1947. So then I worked on a different chapter looking at, and this is what Anandita was also saying, the afterlife of the princely. So I looked at in the last chapter, the subaltern present of a princely past in Rampur. And that's more around how Rampur fared in post partition context and its engagement with contemporary Muslim politics, which is where Rampur becomes interesting because it is the center of the Samajwadi and Congress Muslim politics in Uttar Pradesh, represented by Azam Khan.
Thank you, thank you. That's excellent. Excellent way to, way to think of the next question that I have been thinking of, and a pressing question that I thought, because when you talk of Rampur, you have, as you said, you have, you have, you are looking at it as a nodal center, from where these, tangents, lead out, and you are almost making a world out of it. It's almost, a placemaking, an act of placemaking, a palatial history of Rampur, where you are, you are stuck, you're looking at a long time, long time duration, and, looking at several, important time nodes, history nodes to understand, understand how this place is important. It's almost this act of, inspiring us to collectively reimagine and reinvent Rampur, Rampur as a, as a public space, as a literary, as a culture that, has, has, a literary tradition, as center of modernity, as a center, as a center of, Muslim political identity and growth. So would you want to think with us a little bit more about how this how this world building, this placemaking of Rampur contributes to historiography in general, and what that does to you, or what why would you be interested why would you be interested for the readers to think of a project like that? Long question.
No. It's an important question because when I started, in fact, a lot of people discouraged me saying that Rampur is not that significant, which is true. It's a very small place. It was also not written about in English. There were a couple of very good article on it during for the mutiny. Lance Brennan's very important essay on the mutiny. but it was somehow seen as marginal. And that is both a problem but also interesting possibility. So I was interested in thinking about the marginality of the place to see what one might speak from that location. And post-mutiny period sort of allowed me to that make argument about the shifting nature of cultural center itself. So I work with the concept of marcus, which literally means center, but has all kind of other cultural resonances about site of cultural production. So the placemaking is partly my analytical structure. There was largely an archive of marginality, that it was either a Nawabi place. So I talk a lot about how Nawabi sort of practices were condemned, particularly post Wajid Ali Shah and his writing around decadence on Nawabi culture. So in the book, I look at three ways in which placemaking happened. Those are literary sites of placemaking. So I look at an internal representation where the poets and the rulers, for example, under Kalbi Ali Khan in the first chapter, I talk about literary creation of Rampur as Arampur, or a place of comfort. This is, of course, famously in a Masnavi written by Daag Dehlvi. But that discourse, which is about finding patronage in post-1857 location from a poetic archive, then turns into a ref if you turn to late 19th century reformist archive, somebody like Abdul Halim Sharer started sort of writing of Rampur as Harampur, as a place of decadence or illegality, where the Muslim middle class reformist project was not working because it was ruled by Nawabi practices of excessive spending and patronage of cultural activities, which were frowned by the Ashraf by now, by late 19th century. And then subsequently, I also look at discourse under Raza Ali Khan, where he's trying to create Rampur as an industrial center rather than a poetic center. So that's one way of thinking about placemaking through State Policy Act. And then I look at the wider public archive of Posterbazi and Ishtiharbazi, where they are critiquing Rampur as a place that is dominated by Shias as opposed to the Sunni subject. So there are a whole set of different archives of placemaking. But in this political constellation, placemaking happens through a variety of discourse, of a state discourse, but also a public discourse of contestation. I did spend some time looking at Urdu genres of placemaking, particularly local tarikh, tazkiras of locality, not broader tazkiras of Sufis and poets, but tazkiras around cities. Another way in which one can think of space making is family genealogies or shajaras located within the city. So I've written elsewhere about the social production of space and emotion, and emotions are quite central into making of a place or turning a space into a place. And in that sense, it is both a political project, but it's also an affective project. It depends on which archive or genre you are approaching the question. So I think of if space has a history, history also is a very spatial category. We sometimes think of history as temporal. It's also very spatial. So it's not just a question of scales and graph, but literally the spatiality of history. What are the grounds on which people actually talk about their historical experience? They are not about a nation state graph or boundaries. They're often very localized, very personal spaces. So in the book, I talk about streets, doors, courtyards, that sort of give you a flavor of Rampur, not just as a state, but as a lived place. I don't know if that answer, but it's a question that depends also on how we are approaching it through the archival, whether they're political or affective.
No, yeah, that's a really in very interesting take on the project of placemaking. So, an associated question, I think this is it just might be a little tangential, but and I'm wondering what how you approach the spatializing vis-a-vis placemaking, because I noticed the presence of just two maps in the entire book. And it's a book about a place with just two maps, which is quite unusual. And that's when I, and one of those moments which struck me as that you're also doing something deeply political against the colonial projects of spatial, social spaces, as opposed to what you're articulating as these affective registers of placemaking.
I mean, I think when I brought the question of geography and scale, of course, we think of cartographic logic, and maps are, of course, the first archival imaginary. I actually chose the two maps to give a different sort of geography. If you notice, one is a Urdu map, and the other is a more, Rampur State Gazette, meant, of course, for colonial logics of identifying places for revenue extraction and other. So there are two different ways. In the Urdu map, you do get a much better sense of gates and lived place, as opposed to the English map, which is mostly for, I think, administrative revenue reasons. So that's one. There were many other maps. In fact, all other kasbas related to Rampur have their own little histories and all. So even though I'm giving an impression it's a local study, there's far more lower registers that one could have gone into. It's partly both a good thing, but a bad thing that this happens to be the first book on Rampur. So I had to make some compromise and just keep the graph at the larger level. And I think one could do further studies of, Kasbas and Mohalla, because Rampur, although doesn't have that much work in English, Rampur is full of local Urdu scholarship, not just on the Rampur state, but on different Mohallas and spaces around, because a lot of the Mohallas are also around the individual. I talk about it in one of the plays named after one of the elders. And that sort of then also leads to placemaking around person. So a person name and a place name is often connected. Their graves are often around the neighborhood, not in a graveyard. So there are a variety of other ways in which one could. In the article that I publish, I in fact use the grave as a way of thinking about the place. So that there can be different ways of thinking about space and its archive. I wrote a piece about an urban history where I looked at something called Rampur Album, which was presented to Lord Curzon. There you have a different sense of space making, which is visual, which was gifted to Curzon. It's mostly around the modern Indo-Saracenic architecture. It's about architecture of modernity or architecture of legitimacy, as I am, Bishop Mohipati called it. So I think what you're asking is, again, I would hesitate to give like one kind of an argument for that, because I think it really depends on how you are approaching the question. In the colonial archive, it is largely around structures and institution of modernity. But if you look at from Rohilla's own self-understanding of the perspective place, you would see mazars and graveyards as an important site of that placemaking. So there is more literary element to it, but there could be more maps and more visual representation. In fact, there is a photographer who has just completed a wonderful project on documenting different places. And there are now new scholars who are looking at, based in Rampur, looking at these, increasingly, walls and gates that are being demolished. So there's a way in which there's a lot of interest in different space making. In fact, one of the source I cite, CIVG, I mentioned that the journal's last page always carry an image of structures or a street of Rampur. So there are different ways in sort of imagining the question of space.
I think you've given us a lot to think about Rampur at a at a very local at a local level, and then at the same time at a broader level, be it the colonial, be it through the colonial archive, or be it through the national national sensibility that comes with Rampur, Rampur as a Muslim-dominated princely state that became a part of India. So it's a very interesting move between the local and the colonial, national, colonial slash national, and very interesting switch between the local and the global as well. So so somewhere I see that you are using space as a methodology as well, and I'm sure that's not the only methodology you're using, but one of the one of the many. So beyond beyond that, what are the other methodologies that you have considered, or that you have considered for for your project?
Well, in this case, as I mentioned before, I was interested in thinking alongside literary and the historical. So that is, I think, more clearly used. I mean, spread across the book, but I think chapter four, which is about Rampuri's own self-representation, there I do engage a lot with genres, Urdu literary debate around genres. But I don't see this as a question of genre and language only, which is how sometimes these texts are read as. So they're read as site of literary debates. But as a historian, I approach them in a slightly different way. They're both site of literary, but also the making of the historical experience. So that's another thing that I hope readers will see, because I think there's so much interesting work in both Urdu studies, which is prolific, particularly in American universities, and then there are, of course, Department of Islamic Studies or History Department, where people do studies on Islam in South Asia. But strangely, they don't intersect, or they don't speak to each other. And I wanted to do something that sort of would bring those set of conversation. So, for example, the way I use Abdul Halim Sharr's text, which have been studied by the people, as not just a debate around literary taste, but also situated in historical contestation, politics between Shias and Sunni, between Rampur and Lucknow. So there's a way in which novels, poet Masnavi by Dagh or Jashn-e Benazir, which we sort of then translate. I work with a more literary oriented friend of mine, Shad Naved. That was also done partly to show what a literary and historical approach can reveal to us. And a text like that is both a literary text about Rekhti poetry, but it's also a deeply important archive of Rampur. So that's another thing that sort of interested me. And lastly, I would say, and it shows more evidently in the last chapter, was to think of the historical and the affective or emotion. And there I was more interested in thinking about not just the history of emotion, but the politics of emotion too. So what are ways in which we can think of particularly emotion of nostalgia in not just a temporal, but also spatial mode. So not just a longing for a time, but also a place gone by, which is why in that chapter, I looked at not just Rampuris in India, who might long for a time, princely Nawabi time, but also Rampuris in Pakistan, who also think of that as a space left behind. So that's again something I'm interested in thinking of the emotion, not just about feelings within a subject, but also something like a historical factor that the historian can productively use to think about histories beyond spatial division. So that chapter looks at letters and contribution in a Urdu journal from Pakistan published in Rampur to think of traffic in emotion. or exchange in emotion when movement of people is not allowed. So how books and letters are exchanged to retain this history of connection. So I would say, yeah, that those were the two sides that I was interested in, sort of locating my work. And I think those are two methods that hopefully will be something that perhaps people can disagree but engage with, because I think there are all these archival shifts that we notice. And I think the question of the archival is not just about the old issue of going to an archive. It's also about thinking of archives as imagination or imaginaire, as more recent work on archives tells us. And sort of bring the question of archive into debates around intellectual history or debate around also legal history. So there's a way in which I think engagement with history of emotion is interesting, not just for a history of emotion, but also around question of what are archives, which is how I sort of then sort of call what I have written in the last chapter as affective archives. Archives as both around emotions of emotion, but also as archives as something that shape our imagination and are affective in their own right. Yeah, so that's a long drawn answer to your more precise question.
No, I think that was very that was really helpful, and it's a great segue to something to bring the audience back to the early part of the book, and I think we I would like to continue your discussion on this, how what the history of emotion does to different kinds of archival histories, and use poetic sovereignty. And I felt like it was just like this thing that you laid out, and then it's for a brief moment, and then it went on. Of course, your concerns were different, but even to think of the decadence of the Nawab, the Akhri Mushaira, the era of nostalgia, and so on, to rephrase that moment through poetic sovereignty did something novel. And thinking of, for instance, when I'm kind of ruminating over the pre-1857 moment, to think of how there are like this assemblage of local actors, local states, from Assam to Banaras, we who keep on doing something that Rampur is actually grappling with, and you can see those registers in that poetic sovereignty. So the question I would think of is, yes, how does the poetic sovereignty lay out for the audience? And to think deeper is, I kind of felt there was a there was so much more that we could in use poetic sovereignty as a moment to counter different like spatial registers of sovereignty, and of how sovereignty is generally understood as this 1857 moment, a moment of loss, and then it's just a moment of loss, that the Ahmed Ali a century later. So I think I would combine these questions and see what you have to you say about this.
Yeah, no, that is an accurate complaint. I think that chapter deserved more elaboration. It's also a chapter I wrote as a response from the book reviewer, because they wanted a graph of some pre-1857 background. I would say that the quote that I start with, that if you wanted to be a successful diwan leader, you had to also write a diwan, is a very good way to answer that question. I started thinking of the concept of poetic sovereignty when I had reviewed two books on Mughal period. One was on Bahadur Shah Zafar, and the other was on a Mughal bureaucrat who was also a prolific writer. And that's when I started thinking about the fact that why would people write poetry when the world is falling apart, especially the ruler? And that sort of then makes you think that even now, people may not remember what Bahadur Shah Zafar did as a ruler, but they remember his sher. And those shers are his only way of retaining some element of his historical presence. I also took the poetic sovereignty argument more seriously. It depends on when you're writing that chapter. I was also it was around the time that Shaheen Bagh was happening, and I was thinking a lot about the presence of poetry in political protest. I happened to be in Delhi at that time, and that sort of made me rethink some of the ways I was thinking about poetry. So to come back to your question, it can be further elaborated. It's a question that is much more productively posed, I would say, in pre-colonial time. So 18th century is a very good time to ask that question because there's a proliferation of the poetic archive. In case of Rampur, it actually survives till at least Kalbelikar, because he was a more prolific poet. I think what I was trying to say, and that's why I used two other poets apart from Kalbeli Khan, whom I have not discussed in greater detail, except for his Hajnama. And because I thought that was an interesting way of thinking about sovereignty and poetry together. He has other divans that perhaps one can write about further. So what I wanted to say was to think about. And Barbara Metcalfe is now working on the Begums of Bhopal, who also wrote poetry, and was to think about why are these people writing poetry, all these rulers. One way is to think of this as just these are bored people who just wants to have some kind of literary legitimacy. But that's not true. A lot of their poetry is serious effort. They try to not only patronize poets, but particularly poetry as a site of articulating a sovereignty was interesting when I looked at the Hajnama, which is not in prose. It's at the intersection of a versified elaboration of his visit to the Kaaba. And as I sort of suggest in the reading of the initial dedication, he's talking it as the sanctuary, the candle of the holy sanctuary, as also while he says in the dedication that the colonial state allows for this possibility, but in some way, but he also eventually attributes the real sovereignty to the divine or the holy. And of course, he submits this text to the Kaaba library. So there are various ways in which you can think of why this text is written not in Urdu, but also in Arabic and Turkish. What are people doing with different language being deployed at different sites? So that would be one. And his pen name is Nawab, which is also interesting that he retains a category that is his political title as his poetic name. So those were various things that struck me about the presence of poetry. But also if you look at the two other example of poets I showed, which is Dagh Dehlvi's Masnavi Faryad-e-Dagh and Jashn-e-Benazir by Mir-e-Arabi Saab, I thought both were also creating the sense of the last space that is available to them, whether it's the festival fair of Jashn-e-Benazir or this Masnavi that Dagh is sort of dedicating to a courtesan whom he also met at the festival fair as a site of keeping that imagination alive, which was otherwise being frowned upon in other area. So I think of poetic sovereignty not necessarily only as a political question, but also a site of claiming space when others are being denied. But this is also to retrieve the poetic archive from the realm of literary to also place it alongside debate around political archive. So that's a gesture, but you're right that it needs further elaboration. And this is something I think that needs further work. Yeah.
No, I'd say it's a really inspiring move to then think, use those methods to rethink something that we're all doing. But thank you for that answer.
Yeah, that was yeah, that actually the concept of poetic sovereignty and how you were led into it is something that's helpful to understand that how every scholar has informed by their own trajectory brings in new understanding to their own project. That's interesting. In fact, your book also helps me, again, as I said, every scholar takes something away from your book, from a book, even if the author didn't intend that. I thought your book was doing a very interesting, interesting, it was making many interesting echoes around the Muslim internationalism of the late 19th century and the 20th century through a princely state located in colonial South Asia, and then as it becomes a part of of a decolonized nation as a post-colonial nation. So how do you see the growth of the intellectual history of Muslim internationalism, pan-Islam in your book and through Rampur and the archive that you're using?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that point also, I think I took it more seriously after I was fortunate to meet Kavita Datla and her book had come out, which made me sort of rethink the question of the international and its connection with the local. So it is spread out in the book at different moment, and I would hesitate to make a same arc about internationalism because the geographies of internationalism changes. You see, the Rohilla states were far more dynamic and translocal. I don't like the word international, perhaps translocal is better in this case, because of the trading network. So the Rohilla traders moved from between Afghanistan, which is now Pakistan, to North India, and also different parts actually all around India. It's only with the coming of the colonial regimes of internationalism that certain forms of movement are sort of stopped. So there are different form of internationalism that colonial state creates, and which is how a lot of the work on Indian Ocean studies, global history, thinks of colonial connection. But it also stops at the forms of internationalism, if you will. So that's the first direct legacy. So, I showed colonial anxieties around Rampur's Rohillas and Afghanistan in particular. So while they used it strategically whenever there would be Anglo-Afghan conflict, it did control movement between what is now Afghanistan and Rampur. So that's one argument to think, and I make that in case of both Kalbi Ali Khan and Hamid Ali Khan, particularly during the Khilafat period. Then there is, of course, the geographies of the Ottoman or the Turkic, which again are connected through patronage of religious site. And some of those connections are regulated. And while they are being used in negotiation with the Ottomans, they are also site of deep suspicion. And I sort of show this file where, all Begums of Bhopal and Rampur Nawabs are under colonial surveillance, even when they are being actually used by the colonial state. So they princely state in that sense are so interesting precisely because although localized, they're very much part of a diverse range of internationalist political maneuver. So the word locality in that sense is both used in a double way, localization as a colonial practice, but speaking from a local perspective to make larger connection. That's the argument that Kavita makes, for example, by looking at Osmania project. Although it's a project technically about Urdu University, it opens a whole set of internationalist translational project. So in that sense, a localization project and internationalism are not opposite, they're often interconnected. So that would be one way of thinking about it. One way of think of internationalism would be to look at the development of Rampur as a library, for example, and its collection of manuscript, not just from India, but also from various countries in what is now the Islamic world, various libraries and places of that. In fact, every year I get emails for somebody working on a manuscript in Yemen that is found only in Rampur. So it's very interesting. I keep thinking about that idea of internationalism, that people are very surprised. Why is this manuscript from Iraq in Rampur? But that's a different model of thinking of internationalism, through books rather than through state and people. More generally, I think there's a lot of scope to think about global or international in princely state. I gesture toward it, but I haven't done too much justice to it. One would be to think about Princely state has global markets of materialities. So that would be to think about. I was fascinated by imports of foreign cars, railways, electricity. I mean, princely state often were the first consumers of these very expensive materialities from Europe or America. So that would be one thing. The other is the presence of European subject in princely state, as you know, ayahs or people hired in the princely staff, not just in the household but in variety of roles, or photographers. So there were a variety of other trajectory that one could take. I look at in the last chapter on Razali Khan, for example, the internationalism on the Indonesia sugar factory geography. That was quite interesting. In fact, the colonial state didn't want that form of internationalism because they were worried that this is opening a whole set of new economic sovereignties. So there are ways in which, instead of thinking of the colonial logic of princely state as disconnected backwaters, in fact, it's colonial modalities that is trying to sort of regulate those very internationalist histories. And I've gestured toward it, but I think this needs further elaboration. Yeah. Kavita's work and Eric Beverley's work is very good in thinking, sort of rehabilitating, particularly Hyderabad in that larger economy. But I think that needs to be done for other states too. Yeah.
Beautiful pointers to think about. Sorry, I beautiful pointers to think about. Like that opens up a lot for us to think about princely states, internationalism, and and beyond.
I think Razak, your humility kind of eludes the fact that the richness of each chapter, and once we look at it, has the capacity to produce so much more dialogues. And out of all this, like, we completely forget that the book is also like a very stern reminder for people in partition studies about how the minority pasts kind of homogenize and flattens identities, and that is a significant part that goes on in the book, and just the richness of it. We've discussed quite a few aspects, but then I just want you to touch briefly on this aspect and before we wrap up. So
Yeah.
Raza, please.
Thank you. I mean, I'm glad you could see I hope that the people would take it in the right direction. I did actually, again, that point came not because I'd planned it. It happened while I was in Rampur, and the chapter documents how I approached one librarian and the other, a madrasa library keeper, and why and how we would normally not use those kind of archive in our essay writing. But to your point, that chapter is about thinking if partition is a long process of partitioning, it's also a site of a long process of people responding to partition in interesting, creative, productive way. So I think it is important, of course, to think of partition as trauma and melancholic and painful, but it's also important to think about what people do after partition. What are ways in which they want to retain those bonds? And I thought, I mean, I'm not a great, fan of this discourse of decline of Urdu and, a discourse of decline, because I think decline also leads to something else. So in that chapter, I was struck by the fact that there's so much prolific traffic of books through all kind of ways between Peshawar, Lahore, Karachi, and Rampur. Now, of course, this is difficult. I myself was not able to go to Pakistan because of visa regimes, but I was able to work on that chapter through the books and through these letters that were then published in this journal I looked at. So I hope what I suggested in that chapter is, of course, the melancholia of partition, but also the nostalgia for pre-partition thing has to be also matched by a contemporary reality of what people do with partition and despite partition. And in that sense, I found this particular journal, Zia, very interesting because it made me rethink some of the Delhi-based argument about partition as disconnection. I think partition can also create different kind of connection and creativity. Yeah.
Thanks, Reza, for entertaining us with our musings. But on that note, I realize we are kind of out of time, and we would like to wrap up the conversation, unless we have some concluding thoughts. But I would like to just say that there are so many different like dyads that also operate in the book. So like the colonial princely, then there's the spatial placemaking, and the other like what you do in the first chapter, the Arampur and Harampur, and these kinds of constant dyads that go on to produce something that is that you say is a place. But thanks, Razak, for this wonderful conversation. Thanks, Anindita.
Thanks to Razak for making this book very lively and lively for us. As we looked at it, you did make a place out of it for us. We know all three of us participated in understanding what Rampur has been over time. So thanks for that interesting your time and your interesting commentary on how the project and process was for you. Thank you.
No, thank you both of you for organizing this, for asking questions that makes one rethink or at least articulate what one was trying to do, and also for both of your ongoing project, which I greatly look forward to reading in future.
Thank you. That means a lot.
It means a lot.
All right, thank you.